Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, what's up? This is Sully from Godsmack. Strap on those boots, baby, because you are now in the trenches of the war room with the one and only Mistress Carey right here on the Mistress Carey podcast.
What's up? This is Joe Rogan, and you're listening to Mistress Carey.
Her hair is so lovely. With the eyes.
Hey, this is Brent from Shinedown, and you're listening to Mistress Carey. Hey, Carey, go put your bra on, girl.
Hey, this is Steven Tyler, and you be listening to the baddest bitch in Boston, Mistress Carey.
What's up? This is Aaron from Stain, and you're listening to Mistress Carey.
Hi, everybody. This is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, and you're listening to the one, the only, Mistress Carey.
Hey, this is David from the band Disturbed, and you're listening to the baddest bitch in Boston, Mistress Carey.
Hi, Bruce Dickinson here from Iron Maiden. Yes, indeed, Miss Whiplash herself, Mrs. Carey, is here to unchain your brain.
Hi, this is Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You're listening to Mistress Carey.
This is Dennis Leary. You are listening to my favorite, Mistress Carey.
Hey, this is Corey from Stone Sour, and you're listening to, you have the privilege of listening to Mistress Carey.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
Hey, it's Mistress Carey, reporting for duty from MCHQ for episode 205 of the Mistress Carey podcast. And before we get to this week's guest, Ed Roland from Collective Soul, I just want to remind you about all of the great gear that you can find in the online shop at mistresscarey.com. And with Mother's Day coming up this weekend, all ladies' t-shirts, tank tops, and the My Mommy Rocks like Mistress Carey baby onesies are 20% off when you use the code MOM2024. Check out the new pullover hoodies and check out the new three-quarter sleeve black-on-black jerseys and the roll-up purple Mistress Carey fleece blanket. Find all that and more in the shop at mistresscarey.com. Ed Roland from Collective Soul promised me last summer that when he had news on Collective Soul and how they were going to celebrate their 30th anniversary, that he would come on the show to talk all about it. Well, this year is their 30th anniversary, and the band is getting ready to release their new double album, Here to Eternity, next Friday, May 17th. They're also headed out with Hootie and the Blowfish on the Summer Camp with Trucks tour that features Edwin McCain and the Bare Naked Ladies. Ed Roland is a man of his word. He said he'd come on the show, and here he is. So allow me to introduce you to Ed Roland from Collective Soul. You can say a lot of things about Ed Roland from Collective Soul, but you cannot say that he is not a man of his word. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. Sorry about last week. I have to tell you a story what happened. You know, we were supposed to do this last week.
Yeah.
At 4:30 in the morning, my wife came downstairs. I have the studio downstairs. And she said, something's burning. I was like, what? And we go outside and there's 8 fire trucks and they're hosing our house down. And I look over to our neighbor, who's about 20 yards away. Their house is ablaze. I had to sit there for 4 hours, my arm around my neighbor, as he watched his house burn to the ground.
No.
It was horrible, horrible. So I was up all night and just kind of a little emotionally beat down a little bit. I've never seen anything like that. And I wish it upon, I don't have any enemies, but if I did, I wouldn't even wish that upon him. It was horrible.
Oh,
so
my God.
For last week.
You don't have to apologize for that. Oh, my God. Everybody's okay, though, right? At least.
Yeah, everybody got out. Okay. It's just, you know, once again, you just sit there and watch your history or, you know, it's, you know, everybody was safe. That's all that matters, you know, but it's still hard to look at your castle go down, for lack of a better term. Everything you've worked in your life is in there and there it goes. Just like that.
I grew up the daughter of a career firefighter. So the concept of like fire safety was ingrained in my sister and I from birth, basically, you know, just
right.
Drilling that into us to be careful about fire drills in the house, stop, drop and roll. Like that stuff was just beaten into our heads. And it's because you just never know when something like
you
that
never
happen.
Know. We did the same thing that night. My wife and I and our son, we're like, here's what happened, son. We got an escape route. You just don't know.
Yeah.
And after that, you just, you take it for granted that everything's fine. But I tell you what, the firemen here in Sandy Springs were, I mean, they were badass. I mean, it was, it's amazing to watch these men and women do their gig, man. It's pretty impressive. Belittles what we do on stage, you know. We're just up acting like fools on stage, and then you see real men and women do the gig, man. It was pretty impressive.
A fire on a structure like that is so hot, and the concept of putting on some gear and running into the middle of it, most of us can't even rationalize doing that, and they do it for a job.
I know. And do you realize how heavy that stuff is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you put that on me, I couldn't take two steps.
That's why when you hear the stories about 9/11 and you hear about all of those firefighters that climbed 60, 70 flights of stairs trying to save people out of the towers with all of that gear on.
That physicality is beyond me. It really is. But anyway, everybody's safe. And once again, I'm glad we got to hook up this week.
Yeah, me
Thanks
too.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I say you're a man of your word because last summer I got to meet you because my friends in Rubicon were touring with you. And you and I spent a bunch of time outside. I told you at one point that Will had come on the show. And you were like, how come Will came on the show and I haven't been on the show? And you told me 2024 was going to be a big year for Collective Soul. And when you had your plan laid out, you promised me you would come on the show to talk about everything. And that is why I say you're a man of your word, because 2024 is a big year for Collective Soul.
And you're a woman of your word. You allowed me on here. Thank you.
Why wouldn't I allow you? Are you kidding me? Of course I'm going to let you on the show.
I don't know.
You know who you are, right?
I think so. I'm a father and a husband.
Yeah. And the lead singer of like one of my favorite bands that I grew up listening to. And you know, the concept of the soundtrack to your life comes up on the show a lot. And, you know, there's the music you grow up listening to. And then at one point in your adolescence, you hear something that you decide you like. And from then on, music is part of your own identity and it's a chosen soundtrack. And I have so many memories, good years in college and throughout my musical career, and Collective Soul is part of that soundtrack. So...
Well, that's awesome. I mean, that's the reward we get for what we do. You know, people go, I don't care about statues or plaques or anything. It's hearing the words you just said. That's our reward. And we thank you for saying that.
Well, let's talk about the soundtrack to your childhood. So growing up, what were you hearing and exposed to in the house? And then what was it that you heard? What band, song, album that you went, oh, no, wait, I like that. And then everything changed for you.
I grew up in it. My dad was a minister of music first. He was actually operatic trained. He was going to Italy to sing opera. And then him and God had a talk, and he decided to be a minister of music first. He eventually became a minister, a preacher. And so in our house, there was no discrimination. But I mean, I didn't know at a young age, but we listened to gospel. We listened to hymnal music. Elvis was always in the house. Johnny Cash was in the house. Jerry Lee Lewis, things like that. It wasn't very pop culture for a young kid. But then at 14 or 12, I can't remember, I think 12, I'd saved up enough. And I remember going, it used to be called Richway. And they had a bend and it had Olivia Newton-John, John Denver, and Elton John's greatest hits. And I was like, and I just wanted to buy music. So I bought my first album was Elton John's greatest hits because he looked so cool. I knew nothing about his music, nothing about John Denver or Olivia Newton-John, which, by the way, all three would have been a great start. But I took that home, and immediately when I put it on, I was like, I want to write songs like Elton and Bernie. And that's literally was the kick of it all. It was Elton John and Bernie Taupin's songwriting. I just want to be a songwriter like them. I didn't want to be a lead singer. That came as by default. Nobody else wanted to sing.
I just want to
be a songwriter.
I interview a lot of songwriters, and Elton and Bernie always come up on the show because – no one that I have ever interviewed and no one they know writes songs the way that Elton and Bernie do. For some reason, that combination and the way they work, nobody else has been able to do it.
You know, I used to try that when I then I started wanting to be a songwriter. So lyrics are the hardest part of a song because that's where you're exposing yourself. Melodies, people go, oh, I like that or I don't. But when you start putting words down, people understand what you're saying. So I used to go buy albums and they'd have the lyrics on the back of them. So I would try to write like Elton did, like just before I even heard the songs, you know, like a just say a Billy Joel song. I remember 52nd Street came out and he had the lyrics on the back of the vinyl. So I would sit there before I put the record on. I would try to write songs to the lyrics. And I'm like, how in the hell does Elton do that? Like, it's so bizarre to me. And how does Bernie just write his poetry down? It's a once in a, I wouldn't even say generation, once in a century, you get people that could collaborate like that. It's amazing. It's fun to see and fun to hear. More importantly, fun to hear.
And not even be in the same room. They said they've never been in the same room when they wrote a song, ever.
Nah. And just back in the day when I got to meet Elton and I was like, how'd this go on? And he go, Bernie just faxes it over to me. I'm like, just faxes you lyrics. And then 30 minutes later, you're done. He goes, yeah, kind of like that left. I'm like, all right.
It's so crazy. Do you remember the first song that you ever wrote?
Completed. No. No, I remember when I picked the guitar up to write songs, I went home that day. A friend of mine let me borrow a guitar. So I went home and I wrote, sat in the room all day and just, you know, it was just noodling. You wasn't chords or anything like that. I was just trying to find a melody. And I'll never forget, I called mom and dad into the living room and said, I wrote my first song. It was first day. I'm sure it was crap, but I'll never forget my mom, you know, being mom, supportive mom's like, oh, it's the greatest thing I ever heard. And I'll never forget. And I just started getting into Paul McCartney and the Beatles at that time. I'll never forget my dad going, because it was horrible, but he goes, I bet it's better than Paul McCartney's first song he wrote. And that struck me like lightning. I was like, all right, I can do this now. Because my pops gave me some credit. Just encouragement.
Well, when you and I met last summer, we spent like a half an hour in the back parking lot behind the Cabot Theater talking about the Beatles and our shared love of the Beatles. Right. And we just started talking about music and you're like, we got to put microphones in front of us if we're going to have this conversation. We got to record this.
Yes, we did. And now we have.
And now all of these years later, Collective Soul this year is celebrating its 30th anniversary. Can you even wrap your brain around that idea?
You know, honestly, I can. Because once everything happened, you know, when we got signed, you know, there's that old saying, you had your whole life to write the first record and 6 months to write the second one. So much pressure. I've never felt pressure because once we got signed, it took pressure off me. It allowed me to really just focus on being a songwriter and focus on being in this band that we had the blessing to, you know, have songs that people liked, a brand, Collective Soul's a brand. And it took years. It took decades, actually, because we were so busy at the very beginning. It was just craziness. And so now we do. We talk about it sometimes. We forget about it. And one guy in the band will say something about it. You remember this time? I'm like, yeah, now I do. Like, that was great. It was fun. So, yeah, we're wrapping our heads around it. But we're still loving what we do and enjoy it. So it's, you know, it's a blessing. We're honored and humbled by it to still be around 30 years later. You know, and still make music.
When I had Will on the show, he talked about what a gift it is to be able to just be in a band and make music with your friends. He said, there's just nothing better than that.
There really is. It's hard to describe because it's every night. It doesn't matter what show, how many shows we've done in a row before we go on. And we're backstage anyway, and we're cutting up and hanging out before we go on. We hug each other, tell each other we love each other. And I think it shows on stage because we really do love each other. We like each other's company, which is strange for a rock and roll band. And, you know, after the show we hang, you know, excuse me. You know, we enjoy each other's company. It's kind of strange.
When I interview bands, I always ask what's harder to keep together, a marriage or a band?
Excuse me, marriage.
you've had luck at both, and I have never ever had somebody say marriage before. Everybody always says a band. Yeah.
Well, I'm dealing with dudes. I know how to deal with dudes. I've lived with dudes my whole life. You women can be difficult, or just not difficult. You're just different. Yeah. And I'm different to my wife, you know, very different to her. She has no pop culture at all. She's a businesswoman. So when she comes downstairs and I got two TVs on, record playing, and I'm reading a book, she's like, "What in the hell are you doing? How can you do this?" And I'm like, "This is just what I do."
I think you have to come from a certain cloth to be able, like, obviously I'm not in a band and not a songwriter, but being in the music business, I do the same thing. Watching TV, phone, music on, and my husband's career military, and it drives him crazy.
Yeah, she calls it noise pollution. And I'm like, I use the analogy of golf. I love golf. So there's a tree in front of you and you got to go through the tree. Well, the tree is 80% air. So that's basically, but when you hit wood, you hit solid wood. And that's kind of my analogy to her. I'm just listening. I'm absorbing everything that's going on. And when it hits. I don't know what else to say. It's just how I am. But other than that, she's a great, great cook, great mom, great wife. Like, there's really no problems. But she told our son the other day, he was like, "Dad's really funny when he's out on the road. When he gets home, he's like quiet and he's serious." And she goes, "Well, at first he's being a parent. And second, he's a dude. He likes being around dudes." You know, it's kind of, that's all I've ever been around my whole life, you know.
Well, all of the band members just always say that it's because there's more. The band, it's five marriages, not just one. And that was the explanation. But you are my first one to ever say the marriage is harder.
Well, because we grew up together. Like, yeah. I've known the guys in the band, I mean, way more than twice as long, if not longer, than I've known my wife, you know. And I mean, everything's fine in the marriage, but it's just, we have that comfort zone that we'll have as a marriage when you get older in your 60s and 70s, where you're like, you know what you're thinking. Like, we know what each other's thinking in the band. And I've always said, we know when to hug each other and we know when to pop the shit out of somebody if they're acting up.
Well, 30 years later, some bands would go, "Let's go out, play the hits, take our foot off the gas a little." Collective Soul goes, "We're going to release a double album and go out on a stadium tour with Hootie." Like,
yeah, sounds fun.
So the new album, Here to Eternity, is coming out on May 17th. Double album. That's a double lot album. Of songs. How long have you guys been working on these songs?
We started last January. I'd met the people that owned Elvis Presley's estate in Palm Springs. He owned two homes when he passed. Of course, everybody knows Graceland, but he had a home that was basically when he died in 77. They Priscilla didn't want anything to do with it. Lisa Marie didn't. So it was just left there. I mean, they took the furniture out and nothing had been done to it. But Elvis had spent his last Thanksgiving, Christmas, and birthday there, and his last three recordings were done there. It was acoustically treated. RCA acoustically treated the room. So what we did, I talked to the guys that owned the home. They're just like, "Yeah, go out there and record at Elvis's house." So we went out there and set up a studio, put furniture in there. I'm the only man that's ever slept in Elvis's bedroom. And it was kind of cool. Lived in Elvis's house, set the control room up in Lisa Marie's room. And I came in with 10 songs. And we started January 2nd. In 4 days, they recorded the song. We record live as a band. We set Johnny up, our drummer, and we horseshoe around him. So in 4 days, they had recorded 10 songs, you know, the basic tracks. And I was like, "Well, we still got this house for 3 more weeks. Why don't y'all take a long, long weekend? Give me 4 days. And I went in, sat in Elvis' party room, listened to my old records that I loved to listen to, the artists that influenced me, and wrote 12 more songs. And they came in and did it in 6 days. We still had 2 weeks to just goof off. So we did some shows and just hung out.
Is that house still just sitting there empty, or are they going to turn it into a permanent studio? It sounds like a great place to record.
Turned into something. They don't know, you know, when the pandemic hit, because I was talking to about doing a show out there before the pandemic hit, where we're going to clean it up and put furniture in there and have, you know, kind of like a Daryl's House thing, where, or like Sammy does, where you interview people, they play an Elvis tune and they support their new music or whatever they want to support. But the pandemic kind of put a halt to that. So I still knew the house was out there, and the guys, Tim and Spike, were so kind to let us go out there, and we had the time of our life. It truly was. You say that every record, but it was truly the most fun I've ever had recording. Everybody in the band was in a good spot. And it was Dean's idea, actually, because we had never recorded west of the Mississippi. And he's like, why don't we ever record on the West Coast? I was like, okay, we'll go to LA. And then I was like, wait. Because we like to record in homes. We're like Zeppelin, the Stones. There's that fantasy that you go into homes and you get to be a part of the culture, the community that you're around. You're not checking in. To me, studios, you check in. So we always rent homes. And I was like, wait a second, Elvis's house, Palm Springs, January. Sounds perfect to me. So that's what we did. Went in there and knocked it out.
I talked to Slash about the idea of recording live versus, you know, doing it the way that I think most of us have seen in the videos on MTV, where each band member goes in and records their individual part and the singer gets locked in a little booth to sing over what they hear in the headphones. Talk to me about why you guys decide every time to record as a full band. What makes it different?
I just think you feel it. You feel the spontaneity. You feel the energy of each other. I mean, I sang out at the pool. I sang outside. So to me, I want to feel the energy of the guys. I don't feel energy if I'm in a booth by myself. It's just sterile to me. And once again, these guys, the band, they're on fire. I mean, I'm blessed that they allowed me to be in this band. They're so badass. And it's just fun to watch everybody's facial expressions when we're doing the song. And, you know, once, like, we'll rehearse the song. I'll show them the song and we'll rehearse for an hour, kind of figure out what the vibe we want. And then we do three, no more than five takes, and it's done. That's how good these cats are.
When you make a double album, you get this whole stack of songs, and then you got to sit around and you got to figure out what's going to be the first impression of the new album. So how did you decide Mother's Love's the single?
I didn't. To be honest with you, I'm so proud of this record. I called management and the radio department, and I said, just put the needle on a song. I don't care which one it is. That's how proud we are of this record. It didn't matter to us. We talked about it as a band. We were like, whatever they choose. You know, so that's how proud we are of this. There's different styles. We experimented just a little bit. You still know it's Collective Soul, but it was just absolutely fun. And like I said, there's no right or wrong song on this record for us. And that's how you should believe as a band, because if you don't believe that, you can't expect the audience to believe it either. So that's how we go about it.
When bands get put on these massive, you know, multi-band ticket summer shows, I've heard bands call it summer camp. So for Hootie and the Blowfish to call this big tour summer camp with trucks, you're going to be in the Northeast three times around me. You're going to be at the Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion on June 13th, the Maine Savings Amphitheater on June 14th, and Fenway Park June 21st. Have you ever been to Fenway?
Oh, yeah. I went to college in Boston. I went to Berkeley, and I went up there. I took my oldest son up there one time and got the special tour. It was fun. Got to go back behind the scoreboard and everything. I used to go see shows, ball games there all the time when I was in college, years and years ago, back in Jim Rice days.
How did I not know you went to Berkeley?
I mean, I didn't go there long. Johnny Rav has, our drummer, has 2 degrees from Berkeley. So, yeah, Boston was very spiritual to me. I learned so much, not musically, more about life, because I was 18 years old and left a small town in Georgia. And all of a sudden, you know, I wasn't the preacher's kid anymore. I was an urban town, big town. It was great.
Boston's a big town, but it's also very small and kind of tribal, and is a very weird city, because we love what we love, and if you love Boston, then we love you. And so even though you're not from there and you were only there a short time, you still are kind of still in the club, though, because you love the city. So we love you.
Yeah, I remember going to the Channel, seeing bands. It was very influential to me back then. What was it, was it the Skunk? What was the?
The Rat.
The Rat. That's it.
In Kenmore Square, yeah.
Yeah. And then BU had the best parties.
They still have some pretty good ones. The Channel was the only place. When I started college and moved to Boston, I was only 17. And the Channel was the only place that would let me in underage without an ID.
Really?
Long live the Channel.
There you go. No, Boston holds many memories, many, many, many great memories, good memories.
I was really excited to have you on the show. Recently, I talked to Jesse James Dupree, and I talked to Hedrick.
How's he doing? How's he doing?
He's good. I just saw him in Vegas not too long ago. He's got a new solo album out. He was working with Brian Johnson from AC/DC. He's got his.
That's awesome.
Got his.
He's a good cat, man. I really enjoy. I hadn't seen him in years, but that's, you know, we catch up every once in a while. He's a good cat, man. I really enjoy him.
One of the hardest working guys in rock and roll, man. That guy's always hustling, doing something.
He is. And he is what he is. Makes
That's
no
right.
apology for
That's
it.
Right.
I love it. I love it. That's what you're supposed to be.
So I talked to him and then I talked to Head from Korn. And the reason why I bring them both up is that Jesse James Dupree and Jackal played Woodstock 94. Korn mm-hmm. played Woodstock 99. This is the 30th anniversary year of Woodstock 94 and the 25th anniversary year of Woodstock 99. I was at both, and Collective Soul is one of the only artists that was at both. So I want to talk to you about your experiences and memories of 94 versus 99.
Well, 94 was, you know, we just, people were just hearing us. And I'll never forget, we drove up and live, the band drove up and we were exchanging pics. We were just excited. We couldn't believe where we were. And I'll never forget, we were, King's X was on that bill too. And they were one of our favorite bands. So I'll never forget, we were following them around like little puppy dogs. Finally, Doug turned around and said, "What do y'all want?" We were like, "Just to say, hey, we love y'all." We were just so naive and new to everything. And it was a little overwhelming to, you know, have a band for 3 months. And basically one of the first shows you do is Woodstock 94. And then you leave there to go tour with Aerosmith. We were just kind of in a whirlwind. Like those first 5 years were just crazy, you know, and trying to make records at the same time. It was great. Now 99 was different. I didn't feel the vibe that I did 94. It just got a little haywire. I think people were trying to overdo and be cooler than thou, for lack of a better term. I just didn't feel the vibe. But I do remember leaving there because I went and did Regis and Kathy Lee the next morning, and we stopped at a truck stop, and John Entwistle was in the truck stop, and I was with our guitar tech, and I was like, "Dude, that's John Entwistle." You know, I'm very shy to meet people. And he says, "Well, go over and say hey." I was like, "I can't do that. I don't, you know, I'm not that guy." So we walked out at the same time he did. And he's like, "Dude, this is your time." So I went, "John, hey, John." And Charlie, our guitar tech, goes, "Dude, he's deaf." "Hey, John," screamed at him. And he turned around and he came over and I introduced myself. And I said, "Hey, I'm Ed from Collective Soul." He goes, "Hold on a second." He brought over his wife. And he goes, "She's your biggest fan." And walked away. And I'm like sitting with his wife. And I'm like, "I just want to talk to John." Well, I got a chance. At least he knows who I am, I guess. Knew who I was.
Anytime I get into a conversation about, you know, greatest concert I ever saw, I say Woodstock 94. Even though I was in the mud and soaking wet. But there was just something about everybody being wet together. Mm-hmm. And seeing artists like, you know, Joe Cocker, obviously, that I grew up as part of the soundtrack of my childhood. Peter right. Gabriel being the last artist to play and it finally stopped raining. Those 3 days of music were so prolific to me. I just graduated from college. It was magic for me. And it
was magic for the artists, too. If you're backstage, all the artists were excited and just happy to be there and just couldn't believe, like, I know we were naive and young, but even the established artists that we hung around and met, they were just, everybody was just thrilled and in great mood and just happy. It was like what you would think Woodstock's supposed to be, just yeah. happy, no egos, none, not at all.
Yeah, it was an absolute blast. I got to talk to you about songwriting, because obviously when you talk about your career, that you're like a songwriter first and being a singer kind of happened after the fact. I always ask songwriters on the show, it's not a favorite song question, it's about the craft. Is there a song by any artist or genre that you look at and go, from a craft perspective, that song is a perfect example of like perfect songwriting? I wish I wrote that song. What would that song be for you?
There's so many, but just coming to my mind would be Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Elton John, because there's so many chords in there, and then it just opens up. Even like Rocket Man has all these chords, and he had that natural knack to open the chorus, so you take a breath. And I think Digging in the Dirt, Peter Gabriel, is one of my all. Like, I think how he did what he did it's not necessarily the melody, and it's the production, it's the whole package he did with that song, if that makes sense. So when you're writing a song, sometimes I write it in my head, I'm thinking, okay, this is what we need to do, and I think he's the master at that, if that makes sense.
I love that song.
Oh God, we covered it for a while because I just loved it. I don't know if we did it justice. We did the best we could.
I'm sure you did it justice just fine. When you go out on the road this summer, you're going to be on the Summer Camp with Trucks tour with Hootie and the Blowfish, the Bare Naked Ladies. You're playing these big, massive...
Edwin McCain,
that's right. You're going to spend, like on every tour, time on the road. And that means stopping at truck stops, not only to yell at John Entwistle, but you're obviously going inside to grab whatever it is you're looking for. So what's your favorite thing to grab in a truck stop? And also, what's the craziest thing that you were just like, I can't believe they're selling that at this truck stop, I'm buying it?
Well, I don't grab it, but the best thing at a truck stop's the restrooms. 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's nothing like being at a truck stop in a restroom and you hear World I Know or one of your songs over there. And I'm like, whoo, I have made it now, man. I am hot.
I was going to ask you, where's the weirdest place you ever came across your own music? 3 a.m. in a truck stop bathroom is a pretty good answer for that, too.
Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, it makes you kind of think about what in the world's going on. We got in this habit where we would buy all stuffed animals we could and truck stops. My brother started it. And so everybody started literally by the end of the tour, our front lounge is full of dolls or, you know, stuff. And so at the last show, we call the children's hospital and they come out and we get to, it's just fun for us to do. And then at the end of the tour, we give it to the children's hospital so kids can have all these stuffed animals and stuff.
I didn't know you guys did that. That's very cool.
Well, it's kind of fun for us because, you know, you find some crazy stuffed animals in there and just fun stuff. I'm trying to think the weirdest thing. There's nothing really weird. It's like Walmart in there now. They're so expansive and anything you want's in there. I try not to eat the food there, but, you know, it's late night. I don't know. I can't think of anything weird. It's like going to Walmart. You know, I'm sure there's something weird in there, but we usually go in there and see who can buy the coolest stuffed animal.
Justin Chancellor from Tool reigned supreme with the answer to that question because he and his wife bought a full suit of armor.
Yeah, that I've seen that. Deer heads. I bought a deer head for Johnny once. Mounted deer head. I don't know. Just like I said, it's like just a Walmart to me.
When you're out on these big tours, there's also the pressure that's added on the lead singer to protect your voice. And as somebody that uses my voice for my job as well, not singing, obviously, because anybody that's ever heard me sing Happy Birthday knows why. But do you do anything specific, especially 30 years later, to protect your voice now?
No, I just warm up. That's it. I just sit in the back of the bus and noodle and warm up. I'm usually writing songs, just sitting back there trying to figure it out and actually refresh my memory on some of the lyrics too, whatever we're doing that night. So I don't.
Do you change up the set list enough where you have to double check the lyrics?
Yes. And sometimes you get so placent with, you know, songs that you sang 5,000 times, like World I Know or Shine. Sometimes you just blank. You're like, you just forget because we're constantly writing. You have to remember this is our 12th release and we have another record coming out in Thanksgiving. And then we have the piano orchestration record coming out next year. So there's constantly things I have to remember. So I have to refresh myself. It just, because you think you're going to know the words of Shine for the rest of your life, but you get up on stage, all of a sudden like, oh God, what? And I've done it before. I just go to Jesse and go, what's the first line? If I get the first line, I'm good. I'm like, what's the first line? Give me a word. Gotcha. And then I'm good.
If I asked you the famed Spinal Tap question, would that be your answer? With Spinal Tap getting a new movie 40 years later, every touring rock band, there's a Spinal Tap reference or whatever. Would that be your Spinal Tap answer of like the craziest bad thing that's happened to you on stage is forgetting the lyrics to your own songs?
For me, it is. I mean, you know, there's technical difficulties that go on sometimes. And, but, you know, that's just part of a live rock and roll show. You know, we don't use tapes. We're a real band. You get what we're going to give you. And that's the best we can do that night. Yeah, basically the guys are tight and everything. It's literally me just growing old, I guess you could say.
One of the things I love about Collective Soul, and it brings me to last summer when I met you, is that you guys bring new bands out on the road with you. As a band mm-hmm. that's been around for 30 years, it would be very easy for you to bring some of your old friends with you that you've known forever, but giving newer bands like my friends in Rubicon the shot to open up for you guys, talk to me about this generation's rock bands, because as you know, rock is dead and has been dead for decades, of course, according to, you know, the magazines.
I don't believe that. And that's one of the reasons we want the young blood out there, because it inspires us also. Be honest with you. Selfishly, we see these young bands, these young kids, and we're like, whoo, we better step it up a little bit. And it's fun for us because it inspires us. And it's a way to give back. And I tell all those young bands, to those cats, Rubicon, that, you know, one day you're going to hopefully be in the position we're in. Always give back. Just give it back. Keep it rolling. It's just part of what we're supposed to do, I think.
Before I let you go, I got to ask you the Geezer question. So I talked to Geezer Butler a while back. He told me that he and Gloria have 13 cats and 5 dogs. And when I asked him how he comes up with names for all of those and keeps track of them all, he told me that they named them all after gangster rappers. After I picked myself up off the floor laughing, I now ask every artist that comes on the show what they have for pets and what they named them and how they came up with the names. But I blame Geezer Butler. It's not something I ever would have asked before, but now it has been dubbed the Geezer question.
All right. So we have a golden doodle, and I surprised my wife. Our past dog was a rescue and he passed. So I waited a year or two. I think I waited a year and a half, but we had a young child at the time. He was like 2. And I was like, I want a dog in the house for our child. So I surprised her and I put on his birth certificate, Dooley, which was Coach Dooley. We're big Georgia Bulldog fans. So Coach Dooley was the coach of Georgia back in the heyday with Herschel Walker. So I had this guy filming it. I thought I was going to be the king of the house. I walk in with a little puppy and he's filming it. And my wife was just so upset because she's still, I guess, reeling from the loss of Shep Dog. And I said, this is Dooley. And, you know, kind of like scared if I'm going to run out. I'm petting him, holding him. She's like, I don't want to talk. You know, screaming and pointing the finger at the camera, telling him to turn it off. And Christopher's like, what do we do? I was like, just be cool. Be cool, man. Just be cool. And then Lennon, our son, walks in and I said, Mom doesn't want to call it Dooley. What do you want to name it? And he was so into Star Wars. So he said, Stormtrooper. I said, that's it, Trooper. So we call him Trooper. He's Stormtrooper. He's white and looks like a Stormtrooper. So it's not as good as Geezer, but that's all I got.
No, but that's good. And it goes back to what you said about keeping a marriage together. Sometimes it's hard, especially when you bring home a puppy. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought I was going to be the hero, and now that they're inseparable, we have to plan. If we go anywhere for vacation or anything, the dog, it has to be set around the dog. And we made him, a service dog. So we take him to like assisted living places and let him walk around. He's a great temperament. I mean, he probably was at Woodstock 68 smoking dope. He's that laid back, you know, he's just a laid back cat. He's a great dog. So we got lucky.
There's never a bad answer to the Geezer question. There's always a good answer.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, I had no idea. And it was all about he and Gloria were going on an African safari and they needed somebody to take care of the animals. Like you said, you plan things mm-hmm. around the animals. And he's like, it's hard for us because we have 13 cats and 5 dogs. And I was like, you what? And when he told me they like Missy after Missy Elliott, Biggie after Biggie Smalls. He went through the whole list and I'm going, Geezer Butler knows this many rappers.
I was about to say, I don't know that many. I know. I mean, good Lord.
These are the things you find out on the Mistress Carrie show, Ed. This is, These are the hard-hitting journalistic questions that get answered on my show.
That's awesome.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that your neighbors and everybody in the neighborhood are safe.
Thank you. I'll let them know. Thank you. And hey, what show are we going to see you at? Which show?
I don't know. I've got three to choose from, but I mean, obviously, if I'm going to pick one, it's Fenway Park, baby.
All right. I like your attitude there. Will you let management know so you can come back and hang out with us?
I would love that. I would love that. Okay.
Bring it on back. Let's go.
All right. Let's do it. All right. I will see you soon. Congratulations on the new song and the new album. And I will see you at Fenway this summer.
Thank you.
See you later.
See you, Spitty.
There he is, Ed Roland from Collective Soul. The new double album, Here to Eternity, comes out next Friday, May 17th. And there are three stops in New England on the Summer Camp with Trucks tour. June 13th at the Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion in Guilford, New Hampshire. June 14th at the Maine Savings Amphitheater in Bangor, Maine. And on June 21st at Fenway Park. Check the links in the show notes of this episode to get your tickets. While you're there, you'll find the link to Will Turpin from Collective Soul and his appearance on episode 132 of the Mistress Carrie podcast. And you'll find the link to this episode's corresponding playlist. I make a playlist for every full-length episode of the Mistress Carrie podcast that features all of my guest music and all the songs and artists that we referenced in the interview. You'll also find all of Ed's links, Collective Soul's links, and the Mistress Carrie links. If you liked what you heard, don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to the Mistress Carrie podcast. New full-length episodes come out every Wednesday, and every weekday, you get the Sit Rep. The Situation Report gives you all your rock news, music headlines, and entertainment updates in about 5 minutes. And you never know when we're going to release a bonus episode. Join me live every Tuesday night at 8:30 Eastern on my official Facebook page, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitch for my weekly video show, Cocktails in the War Room. And you can always find me on the radio. Get the details on all that and more at MistressCarrie.com. The Mistress Carrie Podcast, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.